Good day, and welcome to the Patently Strategic Podcast, where we discuss all things at the intersection of business, technology, and patents. This podcast is a monthly discussion amongst experts in the field of patenting. It is for inventors, founders, and IP professionals alike, established or aspiring. And wherever you sit in that spectrum, we've got a good one in store for you. Today, our expert panel weighs in on Google v. Oracle. This legal contest has been heralded as the World Series of IP cases and the copyright case of the decade. Welcome to the main event. It's a landmark case, 11 years in the making, between two industry heavyweights. In the blue, red, yellow, and green striped shorts weighing in at $1.62 trillion, we have the undisputed king of search and mobile operating system market share, Google, accused of both patent and copyright infringement, against the challenger in the red corner, weighing in at $218 billion, owner of the ubiquitous Java API, Oracle. The prize, a winner-take-or-keep-all purse of $9 billion in damages and a Supreme Court ruling that will dictate the future of software interface copyright law. Ashley Sloat, President and Director of Patent Strategy here at Aurora, will serve as your ringside analyst, cutting through 11 years of case law, three trials, two appeals, endless technology metaphors, all in an illuminating IP conversation that runs the gamut from patent infringement to copyright violation and ultimately settles on a matter of fair use doctrine. Ashley is joined today by an exceptional group of IP and tech domain experts, including Steve Stupp, co-founder and CEO at Exano Inc., David Jackrell, president of Jackrell Consulting, David Cohen, principal at Cohen Sciences, Katrin Corrett, senior director of IP at Perfect Day, Daniel Wright, partnership manager and patent strategist here at Aurora, Shelley Couturier, patent strategist and search specialist at Aurora, Dominic Felice, patent expert at Parole Analytics Inc., and yours truly, Josh Sloat, executive technology advisor at Aurora. Now, to really take our heavyweight boxing metaphor to its full extent, I should send you off into the conversation by playing Michael Buffer's pre-fight, iconically adrenaline-boosting, Let's Get Ready to Rumble. But turns out he owns the rights, and we're not Google.
All right, so everybody introduce yourself, and then, I don't know where I got this icebreaker, it's a little weird, but if you woke up tomorrow as an animal, which animal would you choose to be and why? So, enlighten us. I'm just going to go down the list I have here. So Shelley, you're lucky you get to go first this morning.
Yay me. So hello, everyone. I am Shelley Couturier. I am new to Aurora. Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here. I am going to work on searching, starting up a searching group with them, as well as doing patent prosecution. I became a patent agent in 2000. So my number is kind of low compared to Ashley. And this is how I judge people. What's your number?
Very true.
But I worked for about 10 years in-house corporate with Scientific Atlanta. They were bought out by Cisco Systems. And then I spent about 8 years with Cardinal Intellectual Property doing searching, mainly for law firms and when during litigation, as well as I would search for, we were contractors for the USPTO, so we would do the international search report, the first written opinion. So I have knowledge of patents, and now I'm just ready to really work with Aurora and Ashley and keep continuing that down the road. As far as what animal would I like to be? I don't know. You know what? I was on my treadmill this morning. We were in Zimbabwe, and I thought the giraffes were really stinking cool. I learned this when you have like a giraffe family and they're running. It's called a journey of giraffes. So I thought, yes, I want to be part of that journey of giraffes.
I love it. That's what I think about every time I see you now is a giraffe and your journey. And Steve Stupp, I believe you're up next, sir.
Thank you. Nice to meet you all. I'm Steve Stupp. I am a physicist by training who I like to say does anything but physics, mostly electrical engineering, digital communication, and computer science. I've been a patent agent for coming up on 20 years, written patents for just about everyone except for straight chemistry or biotech. Maybe north of 2,000 or so patent applications over the years. I guess claim to fame or infamy is this comes up now and then. Usually, first time I meet someone at a party, it's the first thing I say. No, I'm kidding. I worked on the first patents for the iPhone back in 2004 with my boss at that time. And those were cases were litigated for a lot of money against Samsung. And in terms of animal that would best describe me, I also like raptors. So I was thinking maybe hawk or cheetah just for sheer unadulterated speed. Another option would be dolphin just for aquatic bliss.
Love it. David Cohen, you're up next.
Oh, hi. Dog. I'd say dog. You know, I have a dog. And, you know, if I were to wake up as, you know, any other animal, would be difficult. You know, it would be hard on her. And so. So I'll go with dog. Probably my favorite animal. Here. Can you see? You come here.
A little bit. Yeah. That's awesome.
Adorable. And but like I've always said, if there's intelligent life out there and they ever find us, I'm pretty sure when they land, they're going to be convinced that the dogs, cats, and children are in charge.
They are. We don't have to think that. They are. Awesome. All right. David Jackrell, you're next up on my list.
Good to meet the new people. My background, I'm a patent agent too. My background is materials science and do work with different law firms and some through my own consulting company as well. That's a tough question. Actually, I'm of split minds on this one, but I'm going to go with a river otter. They're so cool and they look like they're having so much fun every time I see them that, and it's a kind of like a river dog in a way, Dave. building on that too, I guess.
That's awesome. I would have expected a river otter to enter the conversation, but I like it. I like it. All right. And Mr. Dan Wright.
All right. Yeah. Thinking about this, I had to parse down a number of options. I was first thinking bear. I was then thinking bison, but I settled on particularly a great gray owl. So these are these huge, beautiful, majestic owls, incredibly rare that live up in the Sierras and farther north. I've had the privilege of seeing one pretty close. They're quite reclusive, and but honestly, kind of matches with what perhaps my preferred lifestyle is, being out there in the woods, mind your own business, just sitting up in the trees.
And magnificent.
Oh yeah, no, the glory of it all. Of course, I'm gonna take a glorious reclusive bird. That's a pretty Dan option. So, but yeah, just about myself. I work with Aurora. I've been with Aurora for a little over a year now. Generally, patent prosecution, background in organic chemistry. But at this point, I've done so many different tech fields that I'm comfortable taking on most things. So, yep.
Awesome. Thanks, Dan. All right, Dominic.
All right. Hey, good morning, everybody, or afternoon, I guess. Yeah, so my background's for the folks, mechanical engineering, and then bioengineering PhD, and was a patent agent in 2016, kind of worked in a law firm, then in-house, and now I do consulting work. And let's see, if I had to be an animal, dog is definitely close to my heart because I love our little fur babies. But I was also thinking some kind of bird of prey, just because it'd be different to be able to fly around and have a totally different viewpoint on things. So hard to pick one, I guess you could say.
Maybe you could like metamorphosize, between them, given.
Yeah, that'd be awesome.
Awesome. And then do I see, is it Katrin who has the iPhone that's listed or?
Yes, I'm here. I'm sorry. I've missed a couple of meetings. And no, it seems worries. Like the group has grown. I don't know if I'm see quite a few people here now. My background, I think that's the question, right? And then the animal. I started off in-house and then went independent for many years. And how sometimes happens, you get used to a certain client and get tempted to just focus on one one topic or one area. And so I recently, like almost a year and a half ago, I joined one of the clients that I've been working for many years. So now I'm back in house. And my background is in molecular biology, but I think the last 10 years I've mostly worked on, in the synthetic biology and food space. My favorite animal, it's like recently, as you all know, I spent some time on Maui over the winter, and I cannot help but be totally fascinated by turtles. I don't know what it is. Maybe it's the slow pace, I don't care how fast you guys all move. I have my speed here. Sometimes also they seem particularly trusting to me. They're just like swimming around there, with nothing but their home to retreat to, it seems. And somehow that is appealing. Yeah, I would say turtle. And, just like I was surfing out there and just every once in a while, you're just on the water and, suddenly this thing appears next to you and, as opposed to shark or anything else, turtle, I think, is always greeted with delight.
Awesome. Nobody wants to be thought of the shark in terms of terrifying others. Awesome. Thanks, Katrin, and glad that you're back. Josh, you're up next.
Katrin, I really thought you were going to go jungle fowl based on the on sale bar talk. So anyway, hi everyone. Josh Lote. I'm the executive technology advisor at Aurora, part-time podcast producer. I'm an engineer by trade. I've spent the last 20 years building software products for desktop, web, and mobile, roles ranging from the trenches all the way to the C-suite. And things really took off for me during the mobile revolution. So while all these patently strategic chats are great, I'm particularly invested in this one. And my animal, it's a great question. I think the survivalist in me says tardigrade, since it's the only known creature to survive all five mass extinction events on Earth, but not a particularly flattering option. So maybe the optimistic explorer in me says maybe a bird, something like an eagle, getting to fly above it all, protected and in blissful ignorance.
Didn't the tardigrade also survive the vacuum of space for a certain amount of time?
That is correct.
Wow,
I would have stuck with tardigrade.
I'm preparing for interplanetary exploration here with my option as well.
Awesome. Well, thanks for joining everybody. I guess I won't exclude myself from the animal piece. I think I like the idea of some kind of alpaca or llama, partly because, they're useful. They're putting everybody puts their stuff on them when they go backpacking and things like that, depending on your type of backpacking. But they also like being with others that are others around them, other llamas, other alpacas. I think that's kind of cool. But then I think the other kind of interesting feature of llamas is I think they're generally kind, but they definitely have a little bit of a spitty side. I like to think of myself as generally kind, but have a little bit of a spitty side. I can be a little scrappy. So, being the middle child, I think that kind of comes by nature, but so I think that's where I find myself. And my mom would also probably be proud of that response as well. So anyways, I think with that, unless anybody else has anything else that they want to share, we'll kind of jump into the meat of it today. So we're going to be discussing the Google versus Oracle case, which obviously had lots of components to it. And we could spend weeks just, discussing the case law, the different precedent that were cited and what they mean, and the different types of code that were discussed, and the patent part and the copyright part, the fair use part. But obviously we also have other work to do besides discuss these things. But so I'm going to focus on the copyright today. I know that none of us really practice in the copyright space, but I think it has some interesting implications for software and kind of thinking with clients through software and what it might mean, from a copyright and software perspective. So I'm going to turn over here to Josh in a minute to kind of talk through some of the software piece of it. But, save it to say, there was Java software code. It was an application programming interface, and it was authored by Oracle. Very clear, everybody agrees that it was authored by Oracle, and then Google copied portions of the code for use in their Android platform. Now, note that this is actually an older version of their Android platform, but they did indeed copy the declaring code, which Josh will go through, in their Android platform. And so we'll kind of be discussing the court's view of whether there was fair use or not. And even a little bit of the patent stuff too, we'll discuss, but I don't really get into that today just because there's so much of the copyright to discuss. So go ahead, Josh.
Yeah, so I think some historical context is helpful in setting the stage. Like, why was Google trying to effectively recreate Java in the first place, right? So Android needed apps, apps need programmers, and programmers need a programming language. If you look at iPhone and Apple for comparison, Apple originally used a language called Objective-C. They already had a bunch of Mac app developers who knew it. It came along with Next when they acquired Next and reacquired Steve Jobs. So they completely controlled the language destiny. It had some shortcomings though, in that there was a pretty steep learning curve. So, you know, adoption was fast, but it was slower than it might've been if they'd had a friendlier, more popular language. So Google comes along and realizing that those sweet ad dollars aren't just going to come through the browser anymore. They want to compete and they need fast, widespread adoption of Android. Well, they don't have their own language like Apple did. So they start looking into options. And from studying some of the internal communications leaked around this, they preferred Java for a lot of obvious reasons, but they were also considering Microsoft C#. Java was one of the most popular programming languages at the time. So you have lots of existing code and an army that knows how to use it. Almost all non-iPhone development happened in Java at the time, for phones, that is. And who wants to be beholden to Microsoft, especially then? All right, so Sun, not yet Oracle, owns Java at this point. Why doesn't Google just license it? Well, they tried, and they tried several times. The parties reportedly came to financial terms, but according to Google, Sun wanted a lot more control over evolution of the platform than they were comfortable giving up. There's also this tricky open source problem that came along with it. Sun chose to release Java as open source under the GPL license, which is a copyleft viral license. Google fully intended for carriers and OEMs to be able to roll their own proprietary versions of the operating system, but this license made that impossible. The copyleft nature would have turned any OEM or carrier modifications into GPL open source as well. So Google abandons negotiations, declares it's good to be king, and decides to build their own version of Java without a license from Sun. Now, rather than completely reimagining Java, Google started with a functional specification, sort of a paint-by-number style versus starting with a blank canvas, if you will. They used a lot of the keywords, syntax, method names, and arguments that made Java, Java, but they didn't copy the code that implemented that specification. We'll speak technically more about this in a second, but the best real-world analog I can think of is that it would be akin to copying the table of contents from someone else's book and then writing your own chapter content. This isn't a perfect comparison, and we'll get into why after a bit, but just to kind of set a framework for what they did and didn't do. Now, why do they do this? Likely for a couple reasons. The first is traction. You want it to be easy to adopt for a massive Java community. You want to start cranking out apps very quickly. So it's best to give those folks what they already know and increase the odds of it working with huge volumes of existing code. And it was faster because it probably required Google to spend a lot less time thinking about putting together a cohesive architecture. All right, so to really wrap your head around all of the nuance and like the onslaught of metaphors that get dumped out in the rulings, most important terms to understand are number one, API, two, interface declaration code, and three, implementation code. So the Java API or application programmer interface is a massive library of packages, classes, and functions that ships with every modern Java system. The court described it as a user interface for programmers to access pre-written code, and I don't think that's a terrible definition. So APIs contain all the common stuff that most every application needs. So every programmer writing some productivity app, they don't have to think about things like how to do math or perform low-level disk access or how to draw a rectangle. The Java API in particular is split up into packages. Packages are split up into classes, and classes contain groups of similar methods or functions that perform the actual tasks. And the composition, this composition is referred to, this comes up in some of the lower court briefings, structure, sequence, and organization, or the SSO of the API. And it's what Google copied line for line. Practically speaking, it means that Google duplicated the names, arguments, and expected output for 6,088 Java functions. It had duplicated the structure of over 600 classes across 37 different packages. That copied code is collectively referred to as the declaring code or the interface declaration. Those are interchangeable. But Google didn't copy the code that does the actual work inside of these packages, classes, and functions, and they instead re-implemented that from scratch. The code that does the work inside is referred to as the implementation. And for relative perspective, interfaces are typically declared on single lines, while any function implementation can, but probably shouldn't be hundreds of lines long. So they copied a subset of the API's interface, but not its implementation. How this breaks down is they duplicated about 11,500 lines of code out of roughly 2.86 million lines of code that would constitute an entire Java implementation. That equates to roughly about 0.4% of the entirety of Java. That number can be a little bit deceptive though, based on what you use as the denominator. If you're looking strictly at percentage of API declaring code that was duplicated, that number goes up significantly. For instance, I think they copied roughly like 17% of the packages. So unless there are any questions about the tech aspects of this, I'll hand it back over to Ashley to dive into the IP.
Thanks, Josh. So I kind of created this quick little graphic just to kind of show that I think software is really interesting. And I think, you know, this was also iterated in some of the court documents that, you know, software is really unique because it's highly functional, of course, right? It's what computers, that's how they function, right? They use software to perform certain functions. But it's also no, you know, I think Josh can attest to this, there's no, you know, software can be highly creative. You can write it very beautifully where it's very readable. You can also be, you know, not write it very beautifully to where it's very hard to read. There are different ways to do it. There are different languages. And so it is expressive as well. So it's kind of at this interesting intersection of the patent world and the copyright world. And I think that's the district court had some really great case law in there. Like, so you could spend days alone on that around kind of teasing out, you know, in what context should software be more patent related and in what context should it be more copyright protected. And so we're not going to go into those details, but I mean, highly interesting if anybody wants to take a look at it. So the whole battle over the last decade was broken into three phases: patents, copyright, and fair use. Arguably, the courts didn't really complete phase two since they kind of just assumed that software was protectable, especially the declaring code, and kind of jumped to fair use. They also did some patent analysis, but it was pretty quickly ruled that there was no infringement and didn't really continue the process. So, but because this is a group of patent people, I did want to bring up the two patents at least very briefly. There was a number of different patents that were brought up, but they were eventually whittled down to two. This was one of them. The idea of infringement turned on the term simulated execution. Oracle claimed that Google uses simulated execution with their virtual machine, but Google said it did not, and that merely parses files. You know, there was definitely some documents we came across in kind of figuring all this out that really did seem that Google actually could argue that they did do simulation, but ultimately the case was dropped. And then this other reissue patent here from Oracle, again, the argument turned on the term symbolic reference. And again, Google kind of said that we don't use symbolic references. And of course, Oracle argued otherwise. He said the evidence is in the source code, but again, ended up not, you know, continuing down the road and ended up, you know, finding no infringement and getting dropped. So, that was kind of like a very short, and actually it was even pretty difficult to find the few pieces of information about the patent case. I think a lot of the focus and emphasis was on the copyright pieces. So we'll kind of switch over to that. Yeah, go ahead.
I just want to add really, really quickly, though. So that 104 there, that was the one that really got the majority of the attention when it was getting attention. And you know, like the one expert testified to that, you know, the proof was in the code. And if Google didn't use symbolic references the way that Oracle asserts they did, then Android would have been far less performant on Google's Delvik virtual machine. It's really, really, really hard to imagine that they were constantly re-resolving memory addresses on the fly. Probably a conversation for another day, but I would love to know more about why this one settled out the way that it did. And like, I know it went through appeal, but the original trial sounds just borderline comedic.
Yeah, it's interesting to have the software perspective in there. So copyright provisions, we're probably somewhat familiar with these. So it has to be a work of authorship. The work must be original and the work must be fixed in a tangible medium. So from a software perspective, you know, printed out on some sort of disk, pretty easy to satisfy these pieces. And then it was expanded in 1980 to include software. And the way the statute defines software is that a set of statements or instructions to be used directly or indirectly in a computer in order to bring about a certain result. So one could argue that directly or indirectly could be tied to the declaration code and implementation code respectively. So I think you could argue that even though the courts didn't rule on the copyrightability of these pieces of code or these types of code, that the statute probably does cover them given that sentiment. Like I said, there's a lot of case law around, you know, specific use cases of code and when it maybe would or would not satisfy the statute. So moving on, so the two issues before the court from the copyright standpoint is the code authored by Oracle protected by copyright law, which like I said, they didn't really address, which I think is a failure point. And then if it is copyrightable, is the manner in which Google copied it subject to fair use? And so I think the dissenting opinion in the Supreme Court really directly hits on this, that how can you determine a fair use taking if you won't even address the basic issue of copyrightability? But you know, they tried to narrowly construe it, but in some respects, they kind of had the decision of whether it was copyrightable or not based on the fair use position that they took. So we can talk more about that as we go along. So it was interesting. So Google and Oracle did agree throughout this whole saga that it, you know, they agreed what the declaring code is, and they also agreed what Java is and Android, and that the code issue was a work created by Oracle. So they all agree to this. They also agree that to the number of lines that were copied. They also agreed that there were other ways for Google to write API packages. I mean, Microsoft and Apple wrote their own. And they also agreed that Google used the API packages in Android for the same purpose they were created for in Java. It's not like they revolutionized it to use it for, you know, vastly different purpose. It was, you know, as Josh explained, it's, you know, kind of the same use case, right? And, you know, to note, there were phones that were running Java before Google picked it up and put it into Android. So the four-factor test that all the courts used to determine whether fair use was in play was purpose and character of the use, nature of the copyrighted work, quantity and quality taken, and effect on the market. And I'll kind of talk about each of these in turn. What I did here is I kind of focused on the Federal Circuit view, the Supreme Court's majority view, and the Supreme Court's minority view to kind of give a view of from multiple different perspectives. I could have also put the district court in here because that was also a really great opinion, but that just was a little too much. And I thought that the Federal Circuit majority and minority of the Supreme Court kind of showed most of it. And so that's what I have on these next slides. So the purpose and character of the mark. So per the statute, this factor has two primary points or components, whether the use is commercial in nature rather than educational or for public interest purposes, and whether the new work was transformative or simply just replaces the original. And so I think almost all of the reviewing courts agreed that there was commercial gain. Google very much profited from their copying of the Java declaring code in the numbers of billions. Now, they did also release it for free, is my understanding, but that was not the primary endpoint. So from a Federal Circuit perspective, you know, like I said, they agreed that it was commercial, that they definitely stood to profit from it. And that, but then they also went on to say that there was no suggestion that the implementing code was somehow changed the expression or message of the declaring code, that it was very, the output was the same, the use was the same, you know, they basically copied the same, you know, calls for those different functions. And so, you know, it wasn't transformative in nature. So they weighed against fair use in this, in the purpose and character of the use. And the Supreme Court majority again agreed that it was commercial, but then went on to say that Google copied them because programmers had already learned to work with the Sun Java API system and would have been difficult, perhaps prohibitively so, to attract programmers to build this Android smartphone system without them. So they ruled in favor of fair use. So so that's interesting, you know, so they're kind of saying transformative in this context means that, you know, it's kind of, you know, enabling programmers to unlock their abilities and not, you know, create problems for them in being able to build in this new system. So I think you'll see that some of the justices argue that that's not what transformative means for copyright law, that it's just kind of, you know, to make it easier for other people to form derivative works or use the language, and that kind of, you know, guts out a lot of the copyright law. So, and then from a Supreme Court minority, again, from a commercial perspective, in 2015 alone, Google earned $18 billion from their use of Java. And then again, Google used the exact same code for the exact same purpose as Oracle. Now, again, it's just the declaring code, not the implementation code, but as you recall, that is the code that is used to call upon the different functions. And so, you know, they're pretty intimately tied. And so even if you have different implementing code, you're still going to use those same declaring to call those functions up. And so they still copied a fair amount, and it wasn't necessarily transformative, at least in the view of the minority. Somebody have something to want to add? I thought I heard somebody. All right, you feel free to interrupt too. So there's just a lot of stuff here. So then moving on to the nature of the copyrighted work. So, you know, this factor requires courts to assess the level of creativity or functionality in the original work. So this factor turns on whether the work is informational or creative, and the more informational or functional it is, it weighs against fair use. So the Federal Circuit, you know, they basically ruled that the declaring code and the SSO of the 37 packages were sufficiently creative and original. You know, as I think Josh outlined a little bit, you know, it took a lot of thinking to think about how to create a language that was easy to use, easy to adopt, easy to code in. And so there was a lot of innovation around the Java API, around those packages and how to structure them in an easy to use and good format. And so the, you know, Supreme Court majority agrees, Google, and that, you know, but they also say that Google used creativity to develop Android for use in smartphones. And so kind of saying that, you know, that Google also used creativity to change, you know, again, that transformation piece a little bit. And so weighing in favor of fair use. And then from a Supreme Court minority, you know, I think this was interesting. You know, you said declaring code is closer to the core of copyright because that's the piece that the developers can see. And then because that declaring code is then calling up different implementing code. And so really it's that declaring code, which is probably, you know, it's more of the expression of the developer since that's what they're writing and that's what they're seeing, whereas implementing code is being called upon. And so in his opinion, the declaring code is much closer to the user, much more expressive, and is user facing. So his view is neutral or maybe even, you know, favors fair use to some degree, because there is definitely a lot of creativity, but, you know, a functional element to the work.
Yeah, and I'd really like to, you know, underscore Justice Thomas' points there on the dissent. Like there is no one way to do an API. Some are intuitive, really well constructed, and easy to digest, and others are absolutely convoluted, and it's hard to imagine that they were written for human consumption. And you know, that has very little to do with the underlying code and everything to do with the expression of the programmer. And Sun, when they were developing this, like they really prioritized building an intuitive, expressive, easy to grok API. And it worked because Java became the most popular programming language in the world, partially as a result.
I guess I'm a bit confused, a bit fundamentally here as to how something being more creative favors than fair use? Because my understanding, like copyright, you know, is supposed to protect creative things. And to an extent, sure, to take a step out of software, like, you know, you can copyright your novel, you can copyright the painting you made. But like a bunch of data, to my understanding, like if you have a data set that like that ends up in a weird spot with regard to copyright, so that is not necessarily creative, that's just a thing in the world, or a more immediate, just sort of, well, I don't know, maybe I'm getting myself a little mixed up here. And so I guess I'm perplexed as you know, creative works then would enable towards fair use in the sense that then it's a thing that could be copyrighted, and fair use is a thing that can apply to things that are copyrighted. So, but if something is properly a creative aspect and you copied their creative aspect, how does that play into?
It's part of what's really, really, really hard to reconcile about the majority opinion, because they sort of describe it both ways. They talk about it being creative expression, but then also try to paint it as more of a, you know, utilitarian like method of operation, you know, so that they can classify it differently. But mm-hmm. it's definitely speaking out of both sides. Okay. It definitely makes it hard to wrap your head around that aspect of the conclusion.
When I think some of it, I think you're kind of hitting on both pieces, Dan. I think my understanding is, you know, from a creativity, if it is creative, it does lend itself, that's more likely to be copyrightable and then subject to fair use. But also the fact that if it's more functional than creative, you know, it also weighs towards fair use in the sense that, you know, it's not that, you know, because even in copyrighted works, there are more functional aspects versus more creative aspects. And so if you're, you know, potentially using some more of the functional aspects, then they're more likely to be deemed fair use in that context. So I think it's like this weird, you know, in some of the district court opinions, they were talking about how different copyrighted code, you know, depending on if it was being viewed as source code or object code or, you know, declaring code or implementing code, even if it were all copyrighted, that, you know, if it's more functional, you know, it was more likely to be found to be in a fair use camp, but, you know, it still had to be creative in nature to some degree to be in the copyright world. So that's kind of my understanding, but, you know, if somebody has some additional input there, I'd love to hear it.
Like for the functional bit, it's like, oh, well, thing A looks like thing B because it has to, because these parts are functional as opposed to creative.
Right. Yeah, okay. It's functional, and that, you know, and that's the weird part about software. And I think it's where it's been really hard for a lot of courts to wrap their heads around, is that it is ultimately, a lot of it is functional. And so where do you draw the line? You know, copyright protects an expression of an idea and patents protect the idea. And at what point in copyright in software are you approaching the idea as opposed to the expression? I think there were some, you know, Sega decisions and Nintendo decisions that, you know, depending on how many different ways you could have achieved that same end goal, if there were tons of ways you could do it, then it weighed more in favor of a creative copyrightable piece of software. Whereas if it were only like one or two ways to do it, then it weighed against copyrightability because, you know, you were kind of encapsulating the idea more than the expression in that context. So it's definitely this, you know, really interesting world.
And they do say explicitly that they're treating software differently as a result of that, right? Given the functional nature, they said that the court distinguishes software from other copyrightable, you know, media, and that allows them to define a fair use precedent that's like a little bit more lenient than in other forms of media. Sorry, Steve, I think you're going to say something.
All I was going to say is just my sense is the Supreme Court hates these kind of cases. they hate, the only thing I think they hate more than they don't like IP cases in general, but they really hate like patents. But copyright's probably just right like a step above in the basement for them. And if you read the thing, it really just looks like they're trying to get to an answer. And the rest of it's kind of been filled in with a goal in mind. They would never admit that, and it probably didn't come to pass quite that way, but I get the sense that like they have all their clerks who are doing all this research and reading and writing things. And then they're kind of negotiating amongst themselves to try to come up with a majority opinion. And somewhere in that process, they decided where they wanted to be, and the rest of it fell into place to fit that. And so it just makes for terrible case law. Because if you try to understand the logic of what they're doing, there is no logic to what they're doing.
Thank you, Steve. Yeah.
I mean, the Alice ruling is the same thing, right? Mm-hmm. If you read that and you try to figure out what they're doing is patent reform legislation being handled from the judiciary. Mm-hmm. They would never, ever admit that. But they were just like, look, there's way too much patent litigation. It's harming society. We can't get Congress to pass a law. So let's muck this up and throw a wrench in all that litigation. And at the same time, say that it's not a precedent, which is the most preposterous thing anyone ever heard from the Supreme Court, which is saying something. And what they really intended was to just stop litigation for 10 years while the Federal Circuit laid down a series of rulings trying to figure out, well, what the hell is an abstract idea? And you'll see in like 5 years, there'll be a something else, Alice II ruling. And no one will ever remember the original Alice ruling from 2014. That will be the, you know, prima facie obviousness type definition for abstract idea for 101. And, you know, for the rest of time, people will point to that ruling and say, see here, here's what an abstract idea is. This thing is just a dog of a ruling, which basically is like, wow, if we rule in Oracle's favor, all this Android open source phones will be destroyed. And it will be way too, I can't, you know, regardless of what the law says, I'm not prepared to swallow that. It's going to be way too expensive and way too damaging to society. So let's find a way to make this thing go away. That's what this reads like.
And Steve, yeah, I agree with that.
Absolutely. Go ahead, Ashley.
Oh, I was just going to say, you know, I do agree that they kind of had an outline, because if you look at the federal circuits, and you'll kind of see it here, even if you look at their opinion, they definitely, I feel like they really weighed it, right? They had some factors that weighed in favor of fair use. They had some that weighed against fair use. They had some that were maybe sort of neutral. So you can see that they really weighed it. Whereas, as you kind of suggest, Steve, with the Supreme Court, it was like, basically all these are going to be fair use. We're just going to kind of throw in some facts that maybe sort of support that contention. And then we can easily say at the end that, you know, we kind of weighed everything and it was fair use. It seemed way more of a, you know, like you said, making the facts fit to the parameters.
And the only other thing I would add is it really feels at times like this, like they really enjoy the aspect of lifetime appointment to their job. and they just love throwing a grenade down on the federal circuit. But they hate the federal circuit rulings and they love messing with them. Because, you know, judges, if you've ever interacted with them, despise being overruled or criticized by a higher court. And the higher court used to be a lower court judge, and they know what that feels like. So they tend to have enormous deference to each other and are very loath to say, you know, and when you read this thing, they just basically tear up all the work from the Federal Circuit Court, which was really careful and deliberative and tried to really get to the heart of a legal issue. And they just were like, no, and here's what I'm doing because I can do it because I've got a lifetime appointment. Now go away and never come back to my court.
Yeah, 1,000% to all that stuff. This was completely, you know, an outcome versus letter of the law sort of decision. And, you know, they even baked a little confession in there. If you read closely, it says, the majority opinion says, Congress and the courts have limited the scope of copyright protection to ensure that a copyright holder's monopoly does not harm the public interest. You know, they made sure to make that clear several times that, like, it's okay for us to bend and twist reality and redefine some words because public interest.
Yeah, exactly. And I have actually a couple of points. Yeah, go ahead, Steve.
I was just going to say, so with that all in mind, I mean, we can slay trees worth of you know, articles that'll be written trying to parse these words and make some sense of it, but it's just one of these nonsensical rulings that's it.
Right.
You know, what it comes down to is the amount of harm caused by ruling in Oracle's favor was not something they could stomach, and the rest of it is just putting square pegs in round holes to make that work.
Yep. No, thanks, Ray. That's great points. And I feel like I'm not alone now reading these things. Yeah, so then moving on to the third factor, quantity and quality taken. So again, they do say that even if they only take a small amount, that, you know, if it's copying the heart or the focal points of the work, then it still weighs against fair use. And so obviously, as we already saw, you know, it was a small amount of the overall code. If you look at just the proportion of declaring code, it was obviously a more substantial portion. I think Josh said maybe around 17%. But that doesn't really matter if it gets at the heart or the focal point. And, you know, I think I would argue that it was the heart or the focal point of the code, because it was the ease of use, you know, what a lot of developers had adopted. It's what Google wanted to copy to draw people over to their platform. So that suggests that it was really the heart of that code. But turning to the opinions of the Federal Circuit, you know, the parties stipulated that only 170 lines of code were actually necessary to write in the Java language, but they actually copied 11,500 lines of code, 11,330 more lines than necessary. And again, Microsoft and Apple had created their own API structure. And so, you know, could Google have gotten by with just 170 lines, or maybe they should have just done their own? You know, I think that kind of is in everybody's mind. So anyways, they ruled neutral or even against fair use. The Supreme Court majority, I do love this one. The better way to look at the numbers is to take into account that the several million lines that Google did not copy. So it doesn't matter that they did copy some. Just think about it. They didn't copy a lot of other stuff that they could have. And so they ruled, and they also said that, you know, Google argued that it couldn't have achieved what it wanted to with just the 170 lines of code. So that they ruled in favor of fair use as a result. And the minority, again, you know, he said Google does not deny that they copied the heart of it. The declaring code is what attracted programmers to the platform. And the copied work, you know, it could serve as a substantial market substitute for the original, which it did. As you'll see, you know, it basically cost Oracle deals with Amazon and manufacturers and, you know, obviously basically supplanted Java for a lot of different use cases. And so the minority, again, against fair use. So if you didn't read some of this, if you do read any of it, read the minority opinion, because it's pretty awesome in terms of just, you know, I don't know, just does a really nice job of kind of rebutting things.
So several mic drop moments in there.
Yeah. And then market effects. So So the Federal Circuit, the record contains substantial evidence that the Android was used as a substitute for Java and had a huge market impact. It doesn't matter that Oracle never built a smartphone themselves, because it was still a potential market for them, including licensing others to develop derivative works. And so really, you know, even though they never did, or maybe didn't have plans to, it still was a potential market for them. And so they weighed against fair use. Again, the Supreme Court majority, Google's Android platform was part of a distinct market. They said, you know, Android platform offers an entire mobile operating stack, is a very different type of product. But they kind of ignore the fact that, again, there were phones running with Java before Android. And so I would argue that it's not a very different type of product. It's not this whole new use case, right? It's, you know, it's not transformative. It was, you know, just expanding an existing market. But they still ruled in favor of fair use. And the minority, again, this is some of the stats, you know, Google eliminated manufacturers' willingness to pay for Java. Amazon used the cost-free availability of Android to negotiate a 97.5% discount on Oracle licensee. Like I said, Google did try to license it four times, I think, owing to that, you know, basically showing up, you know, that its value. And then Microsoft and Apple developed their own mobile systems. So weighed against fair use. So kind of the result was, you know, the Federal Circuit, you know, said weighing all these factors together, they basically had two against fair use, one for, and one kind of in the middle-ish. They basically said that Google's use was not fair use. Supreme Court majority basically just said, you know, Google re-implemented it into a new use case, and so it was a fair use taking. And the minority said three of the four statutory factors weigh against fair use, even though arguably he kind of argued that all of them weighed against fair use. But he said, you know, the nature of the copyrighted work was one that could have maybe swung in Google's favor, but that did not support fair use. And so kind of the net result of it is it seems like their ruling is indicating that limited copying of declaring code so that programmers can create new implementing code as an act of fair use. So it's kind of, you know, furthering the arts by allowing programmers to kind of put their talents to use. So, you know, my two cents, and we'll open up the floor more, is that I think this is really interesting. I think Steve already kind of hit on it a little bit, is I feel like the courts are twisting, especially the Supreme Court is twisting intellectual property laws to kind of fit an agenda. And a lot of times it's to the detriment of these fields because it creates mass chaos and, you know, arguably harms the ability of U.S. companies to get, or companies in general, to get patents in the U.S. So, for example, in the copyright case, you know, the term transformative was, I think, misrepresented by the Supreme Court majority. And as, you know, the dissenting opinion argued, if that different reading of transformative is eviscerating copyright law because it really, you know, turned that term on its head. And then similarly with patent law, which Steve had alluded to as well, you know, the courts have long held these implicit exceptions to patent law, the whole money, math, and mental. And, you know, those are now, you know, the Supreme Court kind of ran with that in the Alice case and the Myriad cases. And so now it's kind of putting a death nail in software and diagnostic patents to a large degree and creating a lot of confusion. And so, you know, I think in these highly technical areas, I don't know if it's the highly technical nature of the subject matter, or if, like Steve said, they just don't really want to deal with IP, or, you know, Congress's inability to move on these topics. I don't know what it is, but, you know, they're creating of this almost, you know, quote unquote laws through these different interpretations that aren't really statutorily supported. It's creating lots of havoc. And I think, you know, we'll obviously start to see some of that come down through the copyright world as well. So I don't know if anybody else wants to talk, you know, this is some of the positive and negatives. You know, obviously, as Josh and Steve pointed out, we're not going to have to like completely blow up the Android platform now if the opposite ruling would have been found. But this also could create problems for software protection in the future, limiting copyright.
Ashley, if I could just ask, is it fair to say that copyright, separate from this ruling, because I said sometimes I think debating sort of bad case law just makes your head explode. And I think this will be a forgotten ruling. There's not that many copyright rulings anyway. And I think in the pantheon of it all, this one will be kind of looked down upon. But is it fair to say that for copyrights separate from the stuff we're talking about, that central to it is an act of creativity or artistry, mm-hmm. and that it also needs to be concrete? So like you, it has to be, the original statutes are that it has to be like embodied in some material or some such thing.
Mm-hmm. No, right. It has to, you know, are you talking about fixing a tangible medium by that?
Yes.
Yeah. And so, you know, and I think there's a lot of, you bring up a great point. I think, you know, from a software perspective, I think there's still lots of room there for software to be copyrightable. If you look at a lot of the cases that the district court brought up, there's great precedence around, you know, and there's a whole rule set, I think, that a practitioner can make around, you know, how to determine whether, and I'm sure they do, how to determine whether something should be copyrightable or not, whether it's, like I said, source code or object code, how many different ways can you do it? Like, was it expressive, right? Was it, as you indicated, were there 10 different ways to do it, and the way that you chose to do it was unique because it was kind of your creative expression. You found this unique way to do it. It was highly readable, very intuitive, user-friendly, or whatever, you know, and somebody could have done the same thing in a way different way. And so I think there's still ample room there for it, for software in the copyright world.
For what it's worth, one of the attorneys I work with had an interesting take on this case. And he said that, you know, the way Google got the code to copy it in the first place is because they were working with Oracle or with Sun. So in the course of their negotiation to take a license, they had access to the source code.
Oh, interesting.
And so the suggestion was that had Oracle played this differently, they could have just basically sued Google for contract violation.
Hmm.
Because there were terms for sharing of that code during their negotiation. And this might have all played out very, very differently because it would then be really subject to state law.
Right.
And the likelihood is that Google would have lost and would have lost massively had Oracle gone that route.
Is there any ability for that to still be on the table? You know, I mean, if there were interest from Oracle's perspective?
The fact that like many, many years have passed since the breach makes it makes me naively answer probably not, but I don't know is the short.
Right. Yeah, some kind of like latches kind of kicking or something like that.
Yes.
Right. Well, that's interesting. Yeah, I think that's there's so many different angles that they might have gone, and it'd be interesting to be a fly on the wall to see, you know, what the rationale was.
Yeah, that's a real very, very interesting angle. And I do think it is important to note here, you know, we definitely spent a fair amount of time kind of dogging the decision, but like I do, like, as a software developer, I absolutely rejoice in the decision. It's clear that the court landed on the better outcome for software developers and consumers. You know, the opposite would have been a pretty bad deal for interoperability, productivity, and an industry precedent. We can talk about the specifics of that if anybody's interested. But like, probably not the best day for case law, but the software world's probably a better place for it.
Although I would, you know, I'd be okay with not seeing another Android phone for a while. Being an Apple user. Just kidding.
So I agree with the conclusion and the comments about for benefit for software. It's just personally, the last thing we needed was Google even more emboldened than they already are.
Yeah.
I mean, so I'll put this bluntly. I run a bioinformatics startup. And back in 2015, I actually had discussions with Google Research, and I was talking to the guy who headed Google Research at the time, who, as he described it, he said, I'm one of the, 20th earliest employees of the company. And we started talking through what we were doing, and he was like, look, this is all very impressive. Good for you guys. He said, so let's just cut down to brass tacks. How much do you want to be acquired by? And I said, well, what do you mean? He said, well, if the answer is less than $30 million, I can sign for that. So we could start that process now. If it's north of $30 million, realistically, in short order, there's maybe one or two guys at the or gals at the company who can sign for it. And the only reason we'd ever consider buying you is just eyeballs on your screens. So if you don't have a huge market, don't even think about those kind of numbers with us. So if it's below 30 million and we're going to go through that process, it's an acqui-hire. We really could care less about what you're doing. We just want to see your resumes and we'll decide whether you're worth it. But he said, I got to tell you, somewhere in the middle of that process, without NDA, we're going to ask you to show your code to us, what you've been doing. And if we think it's something that we could do without you, we'll just do it ourselves and the process will stop on the spot. And you'll never hear from us ever again. And I was just like, well, I appreciate your frankness. I walked out of there and one of my advisors, who's a professor at UCSD, I just turned to him and I just said, well, I guess I'll never talk to them ever again.
Yeah.
But, the stories from Silicon Valley on HBO are basically inspired by Google. They may have a slogan of do no evil, but don't believe it for a second.
Oh, no. Yeah, I had there was this Into the Shallows, What the Internet is Doing to Our Brains book, and they talk about Google in there and how kind of some of that early conception, some of that early thought process, but then how they've changed over time, to kind of go very much in the opposite direction of that philosophy.
So, I'm just concerned that this particular ruling is basically carte blanche for them to go and steal any software they'd like to.
Right.
Not that they're not already doing that, but now they can really feel like, one, I'm an 800-pound gorilla, so go ahead and sue me. And unless you've got Oracle's kind of budget, I'll be able to outlast you. Two, even if you do, with this ruling in mind, chances are you're going to be thinking you're going to lose because mm-hmm. the Supreme Court hates these kind of cases. And who knows what they're going to come up with.
Right. So do you think that the only answer to the Google problem and similar gorillas is, because I know that there was some talk of legislation around anti-competitive monopolistic reform. Do you think that's like the only solution to these 800-pound gorillas?
I do. I mean, I also think that this ruling, it's interesting. On one hand, I am sure that if an antitrust case is brought, the case law would probably be angled in the opposite direction, away from ruling against Google. And yet I bet you the Supreme Court, for the same kind of political considerations, would be inclined to rule against Google and to declare them a monopoly and to go against the case law. But I do think it's going to take like 10 years. And I think rulings like this are going to embolden Google to keep doing what they've been doing, and it will make something like the company being broken up more of a likelihood than less.
Right.
Personal opinion.
So now the big question is, if we post this recording and tag Google, is it going to be taken down? I'm kidding. Or am I?
our SEO is going to suck on this one.
Exactly.
Oh, awesome. All right. Well, thanks to everybody. I really appreciate the input today. It was a very interesting talk, and I love the discussion. Go live your animal. Go live your animal dream in your human body.
All right. That's all for today, folks. Thanks for listening, and remember to check us out at aurorapatents.com for more great podcasts, blogs, and videos covering all things patent strategy. And if you're an agent or attorney and would like to be part of the discussion, or an inventor with a topic you'd like to hear discussed, email us at podcast@aurorapatents.com. Do remember that this podcast does not constitute legal advice, and until next time, keep calm and patent on.
I would not have expected a river otter to enter the conversation, but I like it.